Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is marine biologist, author, broadcaster, teacher at University of Cambridge, Helen Scales. And we're talking about her new book, Ocean Art, From the Shore to the Deep. Helen, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
I always like it when I get to cover a book that's also really visually beautiful. And this and this is one of those books. I want to emphasize that to the audience, that this is a book that's, the writing part is definitely interesting, but the artwork is really astounding. And you picked a lot of artworks that I wasn't familiar with, which was amazing. But let's start with you. You've always had a love of the ocean, going right down to your childhood. But you were almost tempted to be a visual artist. Talk about that.
Yeah, I think for me, those two things have always gone hand in hand. As soon as I began exploring the edges of the sea myself as a kid, going on beach holidays, looking for seashells, hunting for creatures in rock pools, I was always fascinated by two things. One, what are these things? How do they live here? I want to know more about their lives. So I guess that's the early marine biologist in me was asking those questions. But at the very same time, I was just captivated by how beautiful these things look, their colors, their patterns. And I would do things like, you know, take seashells home with me from the beach and then paint them for myself at home, you know, paint pictures of these creatures I had found and their remains. So I think it's always been there. Why? I don't know. I can't really put words on anything more than it's just always, those two things have always captivated my imagination and my soul, I suppose, whatever that may be. Yeah.
But you almost became an artist.
Well, I guess I never really took that so seriously as the idea of having it as a career. I don't know if I guess the thing that happened for me really was that as I went through high school, certainly back in those days, we're talking a couple of decades ago now, I was really offered the choice, and it was quite a black and white choice. Are you a scientist or are you an artist? You know, to a point I could do both, and then it was like, you've got to choose. And I don't actually remember why, but I took the science route. I think maybe knowing that the art could come with me to some extent, or maybe I didn't think I was good enough at the art to really go that way. But the science route is the route I took at that stage.
I think it's unfortunate you have to make that choice.
It is. I agree. I completely agree. I think, and I hope the book as well almost kind of is a testament to this idea that science and art, there is no clear boundary.
Right.
And they both really feed off each other. And having training in either is such a valuable thing in both of those things. And I don't know if maybe now we're getting towards a more integrated idea of what science and art can be. But certainly when I was in school, I was like, told, you choose. So, yeah.
One of the things you write about in the introduction is about the ethereal aspect of the beauty of a lot of ocean life, and it reminds me I was on a pelagic trip looking at birds, but way off the coast in the Gulf Stream, and the crew caught dorados, the fish dolphin, to eat for lunch, and when they first caught them, they were absolutely visually stunning with these wild blues and greens running over their body. But within a really short time, the colors all faded. And that's true of a lot of ocean life, that the colors aren't fast.
That's it. And I think this is one reason why I think that people in general, many people, I should say, just really have no idea about how beautiful ocean life can be because they don't get to see that. You know, it's a fleeting beauty that we see in living animals, and then animals, you know, perhaps that have been fished out, if you explain, and taken out of the water, and just in those brief moments, they still maintain those colors and those patterns, but it very quickly disappears. And preserving that beauty is a real challenge, and that's something that I talk about in the book, about how scientists and artists have tried to overcome that and grasp onto that fleeting beauty to show other people and you know, spread the word about how beautiful that can be. So I think it's too easy to assume that, you know, fish are slimy and gooey and kind of just not something you would look on as being an attractive, beautiful creature. And that's been the case for, you know, for hundreds and thousands of years, as people have seen the ocean as being a very practical place, somewhere that feeds us, but not always a place of wild wonder and beauty. But the book really, I'm trying to celebrate that idea of people who have, you know, looked and seen and tried to capture that wonder in different ways. Yeah.
One of the things I learned so much in your book, and one of the odd pieces of information I learned is color fades in preserved animals. And if people didn't know that, is, and especially true in fish, that animals that are preserved in liquid, whatever the liquid the museum chooses, the color fades almost instantaneously. But that some museums used to paint their preserved specimens to maintain their color.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it?
That's crazy.
And for me, I get, what stands out learning that, when I found that out myself, is this sudden realization that there's, you know, this long history of taxidermy and preserving animals in museums and for trophy specimens and such so forth. And that's often mammals and birds, and they're, you know, pretty good animals to do that to, if you think about it, because the fur can be preserved, the feathers can keep their beauty. But doing the same thing for fish just is really hard because of the fading of the colors. And so, yeah, often what taxidermists did was to paint the colors on. But the really curious thing I discovered was also that some of these skills have been lost in museums, because actually it's not something that's done quite so much these days. You know, there are other preservation methods that scientists use in combination with things like photography to, you know, to capture images of these things. But there are these beautiful fish in a museum in Bergen in Norway that are still really colorful a long, long time after they were preserved. And the modern day curators are at a loss to understand or to know how the people who did that actually managed to achieve such long-lasting colors. So, and that's another theme that actually runs through the book, through other stories too, which is almost the lost art of preserving fish and other animals from the sea in their beautiful states. And that, you know, there were people in the past who did know and learned how to do that, but their skills have been forgotten. And we don't know how to do it these days. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the layout of the book, because I find this, the layout is wonderful. You have four principal regions of the ocean, and so there's a major section of the book on each of them. Essentially, you start at the shore, and then you go out to the depths. You have a chapter on coasts and beaches. Is there a definition of that area, an exact definition? It's just where the ocean meets the sand or rocks?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Well, how about the shallows, though, the euphotic zone? Is that like you can wade out into it?
Yeah, I guess. So the idea of those four sections was really to start here on land, the part of the earth that we know best to be here, and then moving further away from the place into the unknown. So, yeah, starting at that. The tidal zone, scientists call it the intertidal, space between the high tide and the low tide. So that's that. The coastal chapter really is about that. And by the shallows, I'm really talking about, yeah, moving offshore, but not so far. So perhaps no further than the edges of the continental shelf. So the shallower parts of the sea that generally fringe the continents and land. You know, and some of that can be tens, maybe hundreds of meters, maybe 1,000 feet or so in depth. But then that's kind of the edge of that particular geographical feature. In the book, I'm not being very specific about exactly what I mean by shallow sea, but I guess in that sense of the more familiar parts of the sea, the part that you would see if you stood on a beach and you look out to the horizon. You know, those are the shallow seas. In most places, sometimes it goes deeper, but in most parts of the world, those shallow seas are the ones that fringe the land and that have been known about and are most easily accessible still today. And then after that, we head out into the high seas, the open seas, the much further parts of the ocean, the big, huge blue parts of the planet that, you know, you fly over if you flew from where I am today to where you are today. You fly across this huge expanse of the Atlantic. You know, more than half of the planet is covered in these great big open seas. And then I finish off by taking our readers down into the deep, dark seas, which are deep ocean, many thousands of meters down, that we are still learning so much about.
Yeah, I know. Now, when you talk about the open seas and the abyss, as you describe them in the book, they are a three-dimensional world. When you're talking about the shallows just off of the sand, it's really not that three-dimensional. But when you get out to the open sea, you're talking about creatures that operate in a world structured very differently from ours. I mean, they can go up, down, sideways. And so I don't think we know that much about the open seas at all, as well as the abyss. I think the open seas accounts for an awful lot of the territory of the planet, and I'm sure we don't know that much about it.
I agree, yes. I mean, it is those waters out beyond the horizon that very few people, even today, get to visit in person, in place. You know, yes, there are sailors, there are fishing communities who go out there in fishing vessels, there are scientists. But for the most part, you know, for most people, this is a territory beyond our experiences, beyond our knowledge. And whether that's at the surface, the blue surface parts of those open seas, or the black inky depths lie below it, all of that is the least known part of our planet. I think we can say that for sure, from the surface to the bottom. And that's, you know, for lots of reasons. It's hard to get there. We need pretty high, large amounts of technology to explore those waters. So, you know, it takes a long time to get there. And maybe even also there's a sort of lingering idea that there's not much there. You know, again, you can sit in your airplane, look out of the window, see this blue, endless expanse going on and on, and you think, well, there's nothing down there. But that's an issue of scale. You know, there is plenty there to see. You just got to get in there and see it at the right scale, and a lot of that will require technologies, whether it's a microscope to see these amazing tiny creatures that are invisible to the naked eye, or whether it's just being in the right place at the right time to see a blue whale swim by, you know, a huge, great, big, the biggest animal ever to exist. And that's their home, these open waters. And I find it very exciting. I mean, I think, I would want more people to know about those waters, but I also love that this is our planet. It's a huge part of planet Earth, and we are still learning so much, and there are so many surprises and exciting things to find out, despite hundreds of years of exploration. I find it just really thrilling, and I would love more people to feel that same sense of the joy and wonders of discovering our planet and learning what it is, the other living things that we share this world with. And so many of them, yeah, they're out there floating around in this huge unknown open ocean, many of them colored blue to match that amazing blue surrounding. And their lives are truly fascinating, and we still have so much to learn about them.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight teaches at the University of Cambridge. She's a marine biologist, author, and broadcaster. We're talking about her book, really a beautiful book, Ocean Art, From the Shore to the Deep. Now, the objects that you chose for this book, the art objects, it's an interesting choice because you didn't want to just show ocean creatures as food. You wanted to show art that represented the ocean creatures as inherently on their own and their right to exist. So there's not a lot of catching fish going on in this. And that really shows the first object that you cover in your Coasts and Beaches is one of the wildest objects I have ever seen. I have never seen this. And it's called an adder tree. Or can you do the German?
Yeah, there are various names for these strange medieval constructions, a few of which still exist today in museums around the world. They go by the names, Adatree, Tongue, Sam. And the key thing, this is they're often very shiny, made of silver and gold. And, they were an object that was very valuable. And things were put on display when people had meals and invited guests around. But the key item in that object are these small triangular shaped things called glossopetri or tongue stones. And at the time, people instilled in these objects great powers. They believed that these could detect and possibly even were even an antidote potentially to poisons. And really the existence of these elaborate displays, these stands to display dozens of these things, was as a sign to the guests of the great banquet that the food could be tested for the presence of poison. and therefore, the food is safe to eat. Look, these things have shown us. And there was a technique of dipping your wine, perhaps, into dipping one of these triangular-shaped things into your glass of wine, and it would indicate, by changing its texture and the way it looked, it could tell you whether or not the wine was poisoned. I mean, this is all medieval stories that were being perpetuated at the time, and partly because no one at that point really knew what these triangle shapes actually were, because the truth is that these are fossilized shark teeth. Many of them are coming from Malta. There's a very large deposit aged between 5 and 20 million years ago of very big sharks that existed at that time, and their teeth are very highly, they fossilize pretty well, especially compared to the rest of the shark's body, which is made out of a softer cartilage. They don't have a hard skeleton, so they tend to not fossilize, but they're they are hard enough to fossilize, and they have this distinct triangular shape. But look, they look like snake's tongues. They are very strange objects to find lodged in rocks out on land. And so when people originally found them, they bestowed in them great beliefs and myths, and one of those stories that came out of it was this idea that they could warn of an imminent poisoning, and so you could display them to your guests at a dinner party and reassure them that everything's going to be okay.
Well, as you write about, several different fossils, different fossilized creatures were becoming part of the human culture. There were fossilized trilobites, graptolites, sea urchins, which were called shepherd's crowns or fairy loaves, which I love that. And I love snake stones. Snake stones were the shells of the ammonites, a prehistoric cephalopod. But people would carve like a snake head at the end of it and consider them to be fossilized snakes?
Yeah. It's just wild, isn't it? I love these stories. I think for me, especially the sea urchins and the ammonites are both just so many rich myths and legends and evidence that people really did have very high, great belief in these things. They were very significant. We found them in burial chambers in huge numbers in different parts of the world. And so they clearly had a great significance. They were seen to be very, symbolic of death and the incarnation. We can mostly guess at these sorts of meanings that people had in them. But they're also just beautiful things. And for me, I think that's partly the question here, is finding these odd, strange-shaped, but beautiful objects in nature, these rocks, essentially, these fossilized, what we now know were living things that they turned to stone, but that people, hundreds of thousands of years ago found them and wondered what they were and figured, this must be something special. This must be something with great power, and therefore we'll use it as such, and we'll create these meaningful objects. We'll bury our loved ones with them. we'll send them off into the afterlife, holding on to a fossilized sea urchin and clasped in their hands, or buried with hundreds and thousands of them. And all of that must have taken a huge amount of effort. So imagining what people thought about these things so long ago, I think is a wonderful thing, and having those stories to tell again, and also the stories of the animals themselves that made them, these beautiful, elegant shapes that exist all around the world, and people all around the world have found, the spiraling shell of an ammonite, and and wondered what it was and bestowed in it great meaning. And I hope that learning stories like that will help people see today that there are, you know, there are so many reasons to feel strong connections to the ocean and the way things look, the creatures from the ocean, the way they look. You know, there's a huge amount of significance and importance that people forever have really bestowed in these creatures. So, you know, it's worth our attention and our interest to keep knowing about these things today.
Now, there's a whole thing about seashells in your book. And we only have 5 minutes left. I just want to talk about a couple of things because we're going to run out of sailors' valentines. I love the idea of this. And I a year or two ago, I interviewed somebody who had written this wild book on British gardens, especially during the 19th century, where there were these grottos covered with shells. And what in a first, let's talk about sailors' valentines. What were they?
So I understand that these were decorative, or they still are, there are still examples that exist, decorative pictures of made from seashells, like seashell craft work, if you like, stuck down. And it was, I believe, sailors and whalers in the 19th century, American Yankee whalers, who would come back from these great long trips. They would go away to hunt whales for, you know, a year or so at a time, and then they would bring back these objects, these decorations, to give to their loved ones back home, hence the sailor's valentine. But, you know, historical records show, in fact, that, you know, I thought when I first heard about these, maybe these sailors made these things themselves, you know, when there was no whales around for them to hunt. But it turns out they actually bought them. It was a kind of early maritime souvenirs, and it was people working on them in the island of Barbados, which was often a stopping off point on the way back home, back up to the east coast of North America. They would stop there, and there were craft people there who figured, hey, we can make some money out of, you know, using the shells we have from our island to create these objects, these decorations, sell them to the sailors, and they can take them back home. So it was this, yeah, it was an early, you know, not a holiday souvenir, but, you know, they guys were working, but it was their things they brought home to say, hey, honey, I'm home. Remember me?
But then they also would turn in these shell grottos. In other words, entire places that you could walk into. Sometimes they were part of gardens. And they were just layered with thousands of shells.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been to the shells also in Margate in Kent, which is this one in the UK, which is absolutely enormous and still quite mysterious. But people really don't quite know when it was made or why. But I have been to others, and it was a great Victorian fascination of having, you know, building these sorts of fake caves in a big country mansion, garden of a country mansion, and there would be waterfalls, and the whole thing would be encrusted. You know, I've walked into one, and I have felt like I'm walking into Poseidon's kingdom, or I've become a mermaid or something. You know, it's so strange that people wanted to create these spaces in their own garden. And the work and the number of shells that went into these things. I mean, we're talking thousands of seashells that somebody somewhere must have collected from beaches and brought in and cemented and stuck to the walls of these underground, often underground, sometimes above ground construction. I guess it was this idea of what they thought the ocean was, or, you know, a representation of this underwater kingdom that they wanted to create. It's just fascinating. So strange and so fascinating.
It really is amazing. Now, shells seem like an obvious oceanic creature to make art of. First of all, they usually don't lose colors on the shell. And there's a ton of them. You can find them in a walk along the beach. And there's a wide variety. So it seems like for art about the ocean, shells would be a first place. Is that the earliest oceanic art that we know of, like prehistoric?
I guess, yeah. I mean, I guess in the sense of the first objects from the ocean that people used in a decorative way. You know, we've got a really long history of people finding shells and making them into necklaces and wearing them on their bodies and using other pigments, so ochre pigments, to color them. And there's evidence going back tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. I think some of the oldest have been found in Morocco, dating more than 140,000 years ago. Evidence that people had found small shells, had drilled holes in them, put them on a string, and probably a cord, a leather string of some sort, and worn them on their bodies. And so therefore, they must have had some significance, whether it was just, it looks pretty. But even that is such an important idea for early humans. That, you know, it's really, we can never know what it was they were thinking, but they were clearly thinking something about these objects. And I think that stems as well. Yeah, a shell has this universal, any seashell. Yes, you're right, they're diverse. They've all got these beautiful shapes. They're easy to find. And they are that connection to this huge, big ocean that we don't know, this great unknown space. So it's they really are this sort of gateway to the ocean, I think. And they have been for hundreds of thousands of years. And I still think they are today. For many.
Oh, people are still gaga over shells now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're going to have to stop here. We're completely out of time, and we have barely scratched one section of this book. My guest tonight is marine biologist, author, broadcaster, teacher at the University of Cambridge, Helen Scales. And we're talking about her new book. It is an amazing book. There's fascinating facts and fabulous art. Ocean Art, From the Shore to the Deep. Helen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been wonderful to chat with you. Thanks.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.